And we'll move to our next case, which is United States v. Wallace. Mr. Jaco. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Andrew Jaco, and along with my co-counsel, Trevor Lee, I represent the appellant, Patrick Wallace. Mr. Lee and I are students from the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern Law School, practicing pursuant to Illinois Supreme Court Rule 711. Your Honors, this court represents a troubling shift in the way the government presents evidence against a criminal defendant. Patrick Wallace was denied the specific procedural safeguards guaranteed to him by the Constitution, and this court should reverse his conviction for three reasons. First, the Confrontation Clause prohibited the admission and narration of a video made by a confidential informant.
Well, I don't understand. Confrontation is about being able to confront a witness, right?
That's correct.
So who's the witness here that Wallace didn't have an opportunity to confront?
The witness here, Your Honor, is Andrew Wallace, the government's informant. He was the government's key eyewitness in this case, but the government substituted his testimony, his live testimony, with a weaker substitute, and that was the testimony of its lead investigating officer, Officer Bonnet.
I don't understand. The video is not the testimony of the officer.
Your Honor, the video is the testimony. It's the testimonial statement. Our position is that that is a testimonial statement by Andrew Wallace.
Right.
Exactly. So if the government wanted to introduce that video as to prove the truth of the matters it depicted, which is what it used it for, then it was required to call Andrew Wallace so that...
What if Wallace had died?
Even if Wallace had died, that would not have excused the Confrontation Clause violation here, Your Honor. He would have been unavailable, and there would have been, unless there had been a prior opportunity for cross-examination.
Are you sure? That sounds like a really bad rule.
Well, not here, Your Honor.
Witness makes a recording, then dies, and the recording can't be used?
That's what the Confrontation...
Well, why wouldn't more sensible... approach be to say to the jury, well, you know, the witness died, so he can't be questioned. He left a recording behind, so you can look at the recording, but you should bear in mind that, you know, the person who made it can't be questioned, so you want to be skeptical as to how much weight you give it. Wouldn't that be more sensible?
Your Honor, that might be a more sensible approach, but that's simply not what the Confrontation Clause
really
requires.
That's that in 1791 or whatever they decided that would be improper.
I'm not sure what they would have said to it in 1791.
What do you mean you're not sure they would have said in 1791? You sure they would have said, "Oh, video, yeah, we're going to have that in a couple hundred years, so yeah, we certainly want it. We don't want that to. We don't want video evidence in there."
Well, that's exactly why I'm not sure what they would have said, but this video...
What do you mean you're not sure what they would not have said? What they would have said?
I think they wouldn't have known because they didn't know video existed, but this video is the equivalent of an affidavit.
So if they wouldn't have known, why do you think the question has been decided?
The question was decided by the Supreme Court in Crawford, and it said even if this video evidence here, this might seem reliable, it might seem sensible to allow this video evidence in, but the Supreme Court rejected that view in Crawford. That was the Ohio v. Roberts view that said, we're going to look at the reliability of this.
Well, what is testimonial about this video?
Your Honor, this
it's
video
not
is
an interview of Wallace.
I'm sorry?
It's not an interview of Andrew Wallace. It's the actuality of what he's doing as he's going into this house.
It's testimonial because it was made with the intent and knowledge that it would be used as evidence against the defendant at trial. This video was made after the government already had a warrant to go into the home.
What if it was just a picture with no voice?
That would also pose a Confrontation Clause violation in this case, Your
Honor. What? Wait a second.
I'm sorry?
A picture?
Yes, the government actually introduced still images from the video here and had Officer Bonnet state what these still images depicted. And he simply had no qualifications to state what was going on here. These were Andrew Wallace's personal observations. Only Andrew Wallace was qualified to explain what these pictures said. If your honors turn to
B31... I don't understand. I don't understand that. I mean, what if you had a photograph of a dead body? Isn't that admissible evidence?
Again, your honor, that focuses on the reliability of that. Not in this case, where it's one thing if the police officer who took the photograph then gets up and authenticates it. That is admissible. Same thing with a video. If a police officer puts, say, an unmanned video camera on a wall and then gets up and authenticates that and says nothing else and lets
Why is there no authentication here?
Well, first of all, there was authentication to an extent, certainly, to the extent that Officer Bonnet testified that they placed this video camera
right.
on... I'm sorry?
Yeah.
On Andrew Wallace. But that's different from an unmanned...
What more do you want? I don't understand.
That's different from an unmanned surveillance camera. At that point, nothing else is happening
Different from an unmanned surveillance camera? How?
Because Andrew Wallace was an intervening human actor here. This video was subject to his discretion.
Well, it's plugged into what? It's a button in his shirt or something like that.
That's correct, right? And it only
picked
up...
So what's the big deal? I don't understand. What's the difference between having something attached to your shirt and something that's hanging on a wall? I don't get it.
Because with something attached to your shirt, Your Honor, that's attached to a person, and that person...
Well, so what?
He is ultimately controlling and directing
the video. He's not controlling. It's just on his shirt. What's the control that he's exerting?
Your Honor, even if he's...
What is the control that he's exerting over this device that he's wearing?
The control he's exerting is by choosing what to look at. Whatever this video, the government admits, this video only picked up whatever Andrew Wallace was pointed at. So this is his personal observations. That's what it is. It's nothing more.
No, it's not his personal observation. It's a camera.
Your Honor, even if the video itself
entirely unpersuasive nitpicking.
I'd like to point out that even if the video itself,
you have any other arguments?
We do, Your Honor. We also address a new counsel issue here. And as a threshold matter, this court's use of the Strickland standard...
And your client wants you to pursue that in this direct appeal. It seems awfully intertwined with the ineffective assistance type of argument, which generally is not brought on a direct appeal.
Your Honor, to clarify, we are not bringing an ineffective assistance claim here. And that gets to the heart of our argument with the use of the Strickland standard. But if forced to choose between abandoning this claim or it being considered as an ineffective assistance claim, we would choose to abandon this claim.
Well, how can it not be part of the ineffective assistance claim? You're contending that this counsel didn't act effectively. That's why he sought new counsel?
We're contending that the judge in this case, the district court, made an error by not appointing new counsel, which is a distinct claim from ineffective assistance, which gets to our argument about why...
Well, why would he appoint new counsel if prior counsel wasn't ineffective?
He would appoint new counsel because it goes to the ability of the defendant and the attorney to communicate effectively to present.
And if they don't communicate effectively, that's ineffective assistance, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, it's unclear that that's the same exact standard.
They seem awfully intertwined to me. It seems if you pursue one, you pursue both.
They're intertwined only because of this court's use of Strickland, only because this court requires defendants to prove an additional independent
violation. Did the lawyer
violation.
Testify or give a statement about what he was thinking when he did the whatever it is you're criticizing?
The attorney did testify. The judge allowed, in fact, both the defense attorney and the prosecutor to talk here. But he did that.
Well, is your notion that all the evidence that might be presented in a post-judgment ineffective assistance claim is in the record already?
No, that's the problem.
No,
with
we have more evidence.
There, well, we don't know.
So why don't you wait and bring a separate action then?
Because we think here there was a discrete judicial error that should be evaluated separately from ineffective assistance.
Why should it be evaluated separately?
Because the Supreme Court has recognized that the Sixth Amendment entails more than just a right to effective assistance of counsel. The Sixth Amendment gives specific procedural guarantees, even to indigent defendants.
So has your client chosen to pursue it in that way? Because it carries the risk that we would find it involves the ineffective assistance claim, so he would be then barred from bringing it later if he's not successful here.
Again, Your Honor, our client has chosen specifically to pursue only a denial, challenging the denial of his new counsel motion.
With the risk that it will involve as well the ineffective assistance claim.
Your Honors, we felt compelled to point out to this court that its use of the Strickland standard in this context...
I'm more concerned about what you pointed out to your client, whether your client knows that he's risking the opportunity potentially to bring a 2255 action for ineffective assistance counsel.
We have discussed it, and again, I would make clear to this court that if forced to choose between showing Strickland, which we have argued should not be required after showing an abuse of discretion by the district court, or abandoning this claim and preserving it for a collateral hearing, we would choose the latter. We would choose to abandon this claim if this court is going to stand by its use of the Strickland standard. Because there's simply not the extrinsic evidence necessary to present this claim on direct appeal. But we felt compelled to point out to this court the catch-22 that this standard puts defendants in. It forces them to try to prove something on direct appeal and effective assistance that this court has repeatedly labeled a vertical climb and said is virtually impossible and not the right time to do so. And, as Your Honor has pointed out, if you do try to bring this denial of new counsel motion, you risk wasting what would be a legitimate ineffective assistance claim on collateral review. And a defendant simply should not have to show an independent constitutional violation, which is what ineffective assistance is. It's not a harmlessness standard. It incorporates prejudice within the elements of the violation itself. Once you've shown judicial error at the district court level...
Now what is it you think was the... What's the error? I've lost the thread.
The error was an abuse of discretion by the district court, primarily here in its deficient inquiry. Its inquiry was so deficient that we're left with very little on the record to even understand the full extent of the breakdown.
It's inquiry about what?
It's inquiry about the extent of the communication breakdown between the defendant and his attorney. And this court said in Zilgis and Morrison that you can find abuse of discretion based on a deficient inquiry alone. And here, the trial judge at the first hearing asked a total of two questions, one of which that was, that sounds reasonable to me, doesn't it to you, Mr. Wallace? Which was doing nothing more than trying to advance some sort of agreement on his part. And at the end of that hearing, he had no better understanding than he had at the beginning. He said, I'm not really following what you're saying, certainly not completely. The judge did nothing to get to the core of Wallace's concerns with his attorneys. Your Honors, I'd like to briefly move on to the Miranda issue, unless you have more questions regarding the new counsel.
No, go ahead.
Here, Officer Bonnet directly questioned the defendant, and that question was designed and intended to and was likely to elicit the incriminating response that it did. If you look at the context around this question...
The question is, would you mind stepping over here to talk about this?
The question was, do you want to talk about this? However, again, that might seem like an innocuous question, but this court and U.S. v. Smith said what seems like an innocuous question, if you look at the context, can be a lot more than that. In U.S. v. Smith, the police officer simply asked the defendant, do you remember me? And that was, given the context of them having encountered each other in an incriminating scenario, that was enough. Here, looking at the context, the defendant had been handcuffed for an hour and a half. He had watched evidence, incriminating evidence, paraded by him in this room. And then Officer Mazrum allegedly overheard these same statements whispered to Sandy Johnson. And immediately after that, he went and got Officer Bonnet, brought him back. They were standing there side by side. And he says, do you want to talk about this? That's the government.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Did he then get a Miranda warning?
He did not. He did not get a Miranda warning. None of the officers Mirandized him at any point. He never got a Miranda warning, Your Honor. And the officer knew that that the defendant had just made a potentially incriminating response and came there and sought to elicit that same response with other officers standing there to be able to corroborate it. And that's a very different and a much more powerful piece of evidence to be used against him at trial. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay.
We ask that you reverse and remand.
Thank
you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jago. Mr. Bass?
Good morning, Your Honors. Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. May it please the Court. Your Honors, as to the first issue, the introduction of the video, non-audio but video state evidence, this Court has said on two occasions in Douglas and Woods, that the government is not required to call the informant in the case, and that the informant's credibility as a result is not at issue, and therefore neither the government nor the defendant can call the informant solely for the purpose of impeaching him. Following Douglas and Woods, that was exactly what the government sought out to do in this case. It only introduced the non-audio video portion of the second buy. Now, you don't even get to the hearsay issue in this case unless you find that the non-audio statement, non-audio evidence, is a statement. And the rule does account for the possibility that nonverbal conduct is a statement. And I think the best example of that is in the Martinez case cited by the defendants in the reply brief. If a person sets out to record himself, like the doctor did in Martinez, performing a procedure, and then the government introduces that evidence at trial, then naturally you could conclude that the video, taking a video of oneself, is intended by that person to be his statement of the procedure that he was videotaped doing. In this case, there was nothing like the kind, nothing of that that occurred. The officers placed the video recording device on Mr. Wallace, and it recorded the actions or the what occurred inside the house. It wasn't Mr. Wallace's statement. It was a recording of what happened inside the house, including the actions of the defendant, Mr. Patrick Wallace. So that to the extent that the video recording was a statement of anybody, it was a statement of the defendant, which would be admissible in any event as an admission. So unless your honors have any questions about that, further questions about that issue, I'll move on to the second issue, the denial of the motion to appoint new counsel. I think the record is clear in this case that Mr. Alvarez was in a difficult position and did his best and did, as the district court concluded, a fine job in representing a difficult defendant. I think the record also permits a reasonable inference that the defendant himself had no interest in calling Andrew Wallace. What he wanted introduced into evidence was Mr. Wallace's retracted written statement, more importantly, the DVD of Mr. Wallace retracting his statement. That's what the defendant wanted presented. And despite Mr. Alvarez's knowledge that such evidence was hearsay, he went ahead and filed the motion to admit it. The district court denied it. But you don't even get to the question of Strickland and harmless error in the denial of the motion issue unless you find that there was an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court. And that requires not only that the motion be timely and that the district court failed to conduct an adequate inquiry, but also that there was a total breakdown in communication between the defendant and his counsel, and the record does not support that conclusion. Yes, the record certainly supports that there was an ongoing disagreement between the defendant and his counsel, but only about matters regarding trial strategy, which in the end was for the attorney alone to decide. There was never a breakdown in communication such that the denial of the motion could be considered by this court to be an abuse of discretion. So you don't even get to the Strickland harmless error issue that the defense raises in their brief. Finally, Your Honors, as to the statement, it's the government's position, as we argue in our brief, that Officer Bonnet's question to the defendant of "Would you step out and talk to me?" was not interrogation. Interrogation is a statement or question reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. It's not, the test is not reasonably likely to elicit a non-responsive incriminating response. And the cases that we cite in our brief reflect that. It was a question that called for a simple yes or non-incriminating yes or no question. Would you talk to me? And the defendant, in response to that, volunteered a non-responsive incriminating statement, which he had made to another officer twice earlier. So it wasn't interrogation.
But why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't he be entitled to a Miranda warning at that point? I mean, you're right. Just saying yes or no when you talk to me is not incriminating, but it's the prelude to questioning. So shouldn't he be warned?
Your Honor, I agree. I think it would have been prudent for the officer before he even spoke to the defendant to knowing that the defendant had already made these statements, for him first to administer the Miranda warnings, and then we wouldn't even have this issue. I certainly concede that, but I don't think that the fact that he chose to not to do that and then proceeded just to ask the question of whether or not the defendant would speak with him was interrogation.
What happened after that? What's the next step?
So after the defendant said that, there was no further questioning of him, Your Honor. I think the evidence reflects that there was no questioning after that. That was the end of the encounter.
Just that yes or no?
Yes.
Now is it?
The defendant's response, I don't want to waste your time, everything in that room is mine, which was a repeat of what he'd said twice earlier. That was the end. That was it.
And the earlier statements weren't made directly to an officer, were they? Weren't they made to his Wallace's girlfriend?
Correct, Your Honor. After the officers entered the house, they secured the occupants, which were three people, the defendant.
And they're all in the same room.
And they brought him into the same room.
And Wallace officer, says to his girlfriend, don't worry about it, all the stuff in there is mine, something like that.
Exactly, Your Honor. And Officer
Mazrum. This is overheard by a different officer who.
Correct, Your Honor. Officer Mazrum, who was assigned to stay in that room and monitor the occupants, overheard the defendant say that twice to his girlfriend.
So the statement of questions is simply a repeat of what he had said earlier to the girlfriend.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And Officer Mazrum heard that twice. He then left that room and communicated that to Officer Bonnet, who then came to the room where the defendant was seated and then asked him if he would step out and speak to him. And I, again, Your Honor, readily, if I were advising the officer in hindsight, I would say, avoid the issue, just Mirandize him and then speak to him. But he, of course, didn't do that, and the issue is whether or not his question was interrogation. We would submit that it's not. The Neville case that we cite in our brief, I think, is the most relevant case. The question of would you take a breathalyzer is not interrogation, excuse me. And then finally, even if you were to conclude that it was interrogation, non-Mirandized interrogation, the fact that the defendant had made this statement twice before, which is not challenged on appeal, can only be considered to be cumulative and therefore harmless error. So unless Your Honors have any further questions, the government would
I
ask.
Do have a question.
Yes,
if this court does not buy into Mr. Wallace's argument regarding whether or not the silent video was testimonial, what about Officer Bonnet's narration? Maybe I'm overstating it as far as narration. How about his comments in regards to that video?
Your Honor, I believe that that Officer Bonnet's testimony was proper. He was part of the subsequent search of the house. So he was asked, I asked him on direct examination about things that he observed in the video so that he could then connect those things to what was later found. For example, one of the depictions of the video was a situation where the defendant was standing and in the background of him was the microwave with the light on inside and a measuring cup, which could reasonably be inferred, or if not conclusively inferred, that the video captured the defendant cooking crack cocaine. Now, when Officer Bonnet and the other officers later entered the house and searched it, they seized the microwave. It was inside of which was residue of cocaine, crack cocaine, and they also seized the measuring cup. So Officer Bonnet was testifying to matters about what was shown on the video and then what connecting that to what was later found. Another example would be the vacuum sealer was depicted in the video, and it was also seized. So I don't think there was anything improper about that testimony, Your Honor. And even if there was some question, certainly it wasn't irrelevant. So the question then would be, was it unfairly prejudicial?
Well, he was subject to cross-examination.
He certainly was, Your Honor.
And there was no objection by defense counsel, as I recall.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, no. But just to conclude the answer to your question, Your Honor, even if you were to conclude, I don't believe you can conclude that it was irrelevant testimony. So the only other conclusion would be, was it unfairly prejudicial, meaning that its probative value was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, which commonly calls for the jury to view the evidence on an improper basis. Certainly don't think you get that far, even if there's some question that, in hindsight, the government could have better presented that evidence or I could have better asked the question. But to answer your question, I think the evidence was properly admitted, and we would ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Bass. So, Mr. Lee?
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Trevor Lee, continuing argument on behalf of Patrick Wallace. Judge Lawrence, I want to address a point you brought up at the very end there, and that's Officer Bonnet's narration of the video. And this is our second confrontation issue that my co-counsel didn't quite get to. Judge, the Officer Bonnet's narration of this video was a confrontation issue. The video itself shows very little. You can look at our brief.
Was it objected to?
It was objected to, Your Honor. Look at Record Document 64. Alvarez objected to the video and to any testimonial statements made by Bonnet. And the judge said, okay, thank you. Don't make any objections in the presence of the jury. So this was objected to. Now, the video itself shows very little. If you turn to our Appendix B31 through 40, excuse me, Your Honor, you can see that this video in itself shows absolutely nothing. The only basis that Bonnet had to narrate this video was the out-of-court statements that Andrew Wallace gave him after Andrew Wallace returned from the buy. Bonnet is essentially regurgitating these statements to the jury, narrating this video as it's being played. And as I would contend, the video itself shows nothing. The government contends that perhaps he gathered some knowledge.
Well, was this brought out on cross-examination?
It was brought out on cross-examination, Your Honor, but that doesn't cure the confrontation violation. The government contends that Bonnet learned information about this buy later when he searched the house, but that gives him no basis to narrate the actions of the video, and that's exactly what he did. You can look to Appendix B6 through
17. Well, I don't understand. If he's looked in the house and he's seen these things, can he look at a video and say, well, this, what the video is showing is what I saw in the house. They look the same.
I think there are issues with that, Your Honor, but what he
did... Well, how can there be issues with that? I don't understand.
Okay,
he looks at a picture, and he says, yeah, that looks like what I saw in the house. So
okay,
what can be wrong with
that? Conceding
that... Tell me what can be wrong with that.
I'll concede, Your Honor, that there's nothing wrong with that. What Bonnet can't do is narrate, this is Patrick Wallace selling Andrew Wallace crack cocaine. This is Patrick Wallace putting crack cocaine in the microwave. If you look at the pictures, you'll see that they show no such thing. These were statements that Andrew Wallace gave to Bonnet after the fact that he then gave to the jury. Classic Confrontation Clause issue. Now, Your Honors, Andrew Wallace really was the heart of this case. The government referred to him 115 times, and as you can see from our briefs, he recanted his story. The government contends we didn't want him in, and this is a mischaracterization of the record. At A4, it shows, Appendix 4, it shows that we did ask him to be brought in. We filed a subpoena. We tried to get him in a trial. And the whole time, the government fought tooth and nail for him to be excluded so they could replace his testimony with video evidence. Now, Your Honor,
did you file a material witness subpoena?
We didn't file a material witness subpoena,
why not?
Your Honor. Excuse me?
Why not?
I don't know, Your Honor, why the government, the defense counsel did not file a missing witness subpoena, but he did file a subpoena a month before trial. He put the government on notice that we wanted him called. And I will say that the defense's ability to call Andrew Wallace does not cure the government's obligation to call him for their Confrontation Clause violation. And if there are no further questions, Your Honors, We ask that this court reverse.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Lee and Mr. Jaco, and of course, Mr. Bass. And again, we thank the Bloom for their